She's got her own army up there in Alaska.
In Alaska, if you have any sort of emergency as things are happening in your state, the National Guard is under the command of the governor. That is more of a command role than Barack Obama has ever had.
As commander-in-chief of the Alaska National Guard, a McCain spokesman insists that running mate Sarah Palin could take charge of the Pentagon tomorrow. Commander Palin, all quiet on the Russian front. Convention politics on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 3rd. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, we are going to have reports from St. Paul and the Republican National Convention. It's underway in full force. Also, teenage pregnancy rates in the U.S. are the highest in the industrial world. We'll take a look at the issue beyond the politics of the Republican vice presidential candidate's family. The Taliban's rise is in part thanks to support in Pakistan, according to the New York Times in a new report. These stories and more, but first these headlines.
The Republican National Convention in full swing in St. Paul yesterday, and more on the podium tonight. President Bush addressed the delegates via video link from the White House, his image projected on a giant screen. Then Fred Thompson, a senator, went on the attack.
The Democrats present a history-making nominee for president. History-making in that he's the most liberal, most inexperienced nominee to ever run for president.
Commander-in-Chief of the Alaska National Guard, Sarah Palin, will give a much-anticipated speech tonight. Vice President Cheney is in the oil-rich country of Azerbaijan today. It's his first stop on a tour of former Soviet republics. He's also heading to Georgia and Ukraine. All three countries are key energy exporters.
And it looks like Georgia will be getting more than just a visit from Dick Cheney. Later today, the White House is set to pledge more than $1 billion in aid to the country to be delivered over several years. Gustav is not a hurricane anymore, but it's still drenching parts of Texas and Louisiana. Thousands of New Orleans residents who evacuated ahead of the storm are still in shelters. Mayor Ray Nagin says they will be able to go home soon.
It's been a couple of days now. We promised them that we would bring them back within days and not weeks, and I want to honor that promise.
Nagin says they may be able to start heading home tomorrow.
In politics, Barack Obama is in Ohio talking about the economy. John McCain arrives in St. Paul this afternoon. Oil prices are dipping. They're down more than a dollar and a half in trading in the West today. They fell below $108 a barrel in Asian trading today. The markets are set to open down, and that's interesting because they usually rise when oil prices drop, so there's a lot of volatility on Wall Street this morning. The Dow dropped almost a quarter of a percent yesterday. The S&P down almost half a percent. It opens today at 1277. Boy, Sarah Palin certainly stepped on the third rail in American politics. She's too busy to focus on caring for her five children. Is that the criticism? There's a lot of discussion over how Sarah Palin has raised her family. But is it fair? How equal is mothers' and fathers' responsibilities to take care of their children in the 21st century? That's the subject for The Takeaway today. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Well, she's way more than a walk-on at the Republican National Convention. Sarah Palin, John McCain's running mate, did get a walk-through of the convention hall this morning in preparation for her highly anticipated speech on the convention floor tonight, where she will really be formally introduced to America and the delegates. She will also accept formally a spot on the ticket with John McCain at the convention. Last night, it was President Bush via satellite, Fred Thompson, and Senator Joe Lieberman making their cases to Republicans and, more importantly, independent voters away from the convention hall and watching on television. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is in St. Paul. all week covering the convention for us. Andrea, how is this convention different from what you observed in Denver? I guess size does matter here.
Well, the whole thing feels a whole lot smaller. And as a matter of fact, when I first walked into the Excel Center here in St. Paul, I thought, wow, this must be a much smaller stadium. Nope, same size. It's all in the setup. The folding chairs for the delegations, which are smaller, are all down on the floor. The stage is much lower. And all the marquee guests, Cindy McCain, George H.W. Bush, they're all sitting just a tiny little bit above the floor. So all in all, it creates this intimate feeling, this small feeling. Some Republicans I spoke to yesterday said, look, we're not going to compete with what we did in Denver, so we're just going to do everything lower key and make it look like that is what we're meaning to do.
Well, it's not exactly a lounge act the Republicans are putting together, but what do they have to do at this pageant this week? What's their mission?
A lounge act,
well, they had,
John?
A lounge act, yeah, Republican lounge act in St. Paul.
They have a number of jobs, and of course they have to do it all in three nights rather than four because they didn't have their first night.
Right.
So last night was all about John McCain's biography and vouching for his war service and his service as a senator to the country. And remember, we were talking in Denver about the elaborate signs they had. I think Joe Biden had four different placards during his speech. Well, last night there was one, and on one side it said country first, and on the other side it said service, and that was it. That was the message that they were trying to send. And
so stay on message. They have to
Fire
up the base. They need to, to sort of speak also to the American people broadly. Who was the man for the job last night?
Well, after President Bush said his thing, which he said by videotape, sort of emphasizing the gap between them two, or by satellite hookup, I should say, he sort of did a reprise of his 2004, "We Need the Republican Party to Keep America Safe After 9/11. Out comes Fred Thompson, giving the speech of his life, a far more convincing speech than he ever gave on his own behalf when he was running for president, sort of marshaling his full actor resources. And the first thing he does is talk right back to all of the talk about Sarah Palin and her qualifications and whether she was vetted, and this is what he said.
Some Washington pundits and media big shots are in a frenzy over the selection of a woman who has actually governed rather than just talked a good game on the Sunday talk shows and hit the Washington cocktail circuit.
So which are you, a Washington pundit or a media big shot, Andrea?
Well, apparently I am no friend to John McCain. Thompson went out of his way to talk about the Democrats and their media friends, and that confused me a little bit because I thought that John McCain was supposed to be the darling of the media,
right,
but
right.
Apparently not, according to Fred Thompson. And, then he launches into this big speech in these stentorian tones and sort of milking for the drama and telling in really vivid detail the story of John McCain's being captured and being held in Vietnam, including all the physical details. Here's a little bit of what that was like.
Boarded up cell windows blocking any breath of fresh air. The oppressive heat causing balls the size of baseballs under his arms.
He's not describing the Excel Center, right?
No, he's talking about what it was like and really sort of trying to make people feel that. I mean, that was one of his jobs. He had many. I mean, his jobs
were
to bounce the base.
Just for people who don't know that John McCain was a POW, he's describing his experience in Hanoi, right?
He is. He's describing his capture, and he talked about how John McCain, as Thompson describes it, for propaganda purposes, was offered the opportunity to leave earlier than some of his fellow prisoners who had been in there longer, and how McCain said no and went back and faced the torture. The idea was that this is a man that would do anything for his country. So one of the things, so Fred Thompson, after hitting back on Sarah Palin and sort of really vouching for John McCain and his history, the next job is to go after Barack Obama. He does a very interesting pivot after his whole McCain bio thing to the Obama thing. Listen to how he does it.
It's pretty clear there are two questions that we'll never have to ask ourselves. Who is this man? And can we trust this man with the presidency?
And down on the floor where I was, the crowd just leapt up to its feet and starts yelling, "Yes, we can," for about 2 minutes. Of course, that's the Obama refrain. I mean, they were just so delighted to hear that. And then for good measure, Thompson throws in what turns out to be on the floor. And remember, this is the Republican base that we are speaking to, the biggest applause line of the night.
"We need a president who doesn't think that the protection of the unborn or a newly born baby is above his pay grade."
Now, what does that specifically refer to, Andrea? It refers to McCain and Obama's appearance before representatives of that base, right?
That's right. That was a forum at Saddleback before an evangelical church group. And Obama, when asked when he thought life begins, said, "That's above my pay grade." That was a went over like a lead balloon, as you can imagine, with people who feel that they are very strongly pro-life.
All right. So here in this hall, this relatively intimate hall filled with the stalwart Republican base faithful, I gather no Democrats were allowed in, right?
Well, nope. One, or at least a former Democrat, Joe Lieberman, a very good friend of John McCain, took the stage. And the last time, he may have spoken in Boston in 2004, but if he did, he didn't make much of an impression on me. Last time I remember him speaking was when he was himself playing this sort of Fred Thompson role of throwing out the red meat about the other party, but this is when he was running for vice president. I mean, here's a man who was Al Gore's running mate coming right out to speak to the Republican base, and he was there for a very specific purpose. He was there to make the point that, you know, I am somebody who called myself a Democrat for many years. I hold all these values, but I can vote for John McCain, and if I can make this choice, so can you. And here's a little bit of how he did that.
"Both of the presidential candidates this year have talked about changing the culture of Washington, about breaking through the partisan gridlock and the special interests that are poisoning our politics. But, my friends, only one of them has actually done it."
It's interesting, your characterization there, that the independent status of Lieberman, you say, is pointing out the path for maybe people who are skeptical of John McCain to vote for him, even though he doesn't agree with everything, perhaps, that they agree with.
This crowd felt very good that Lieberman came.
Huh.
But they didn't particularly love what he said. I mean, he at one point was praising Bill Clinton. This was an answer to what Bill Clinton said last week about, they said I was inexperienced too. So Joe Lieberman was trying to make the case, I knew Bill Clinton and Barack Obama is no Bill Clinton. But listen to what he says about immigration. I'm not sure this was the most popular thing to say before this crowd.
"If John McCain was another go-along partisan politician, he never would have led the fight to fix our broken immigration system or actually do something about global warming. But he did. As a matter of fact, friends, if John McCain is just another partisan Republican, then I'm Michael Moore's favorite Democrat."
Clearly, that was a reaction to Michael Moore as much as it was Joe Lieberman.
Yes, clearly. And then he goes on to say, "You may not agree with John McCain, but you can always count on him for straight talk." And that is, in fact, the sort of central argument. He turns to the TV screens and he says, "I'm speaking right to the people who are watching, not necessarily the people in this hall tonight."
Well, it'll be interesting to compare the ratings. There will be a highly anticipated speech tonight at the convention. Explain what Sarah Palin has to do tonight.
Well, she has had no public appearances since she arrived in St. Paul Sunday night, except for one photo op with Laura Bush and Cindy McCain. She has been preparing the speech, I think that it is no underestimation to say that this is the speech of her life. I mean, who was watching TV noon on the Friday before Labor Day weekend? Well, we were, but not too many other people were. So this is really her introduction to America, and she has to sort of prove that she is up to the job, as well as do all the normal things that a vice president presidential candidate does, which is, you know, rile up the crowd and tear down the presidential nominee of the other party and increase their comfort factor. So
she's the headline tonight.
Inside and out are on her.
The pressure's on. Andrea Bernstein coming all week live from St. Paul for us. Andrea is the Takeaway's political director. Thank you. More on the convention tomorrow. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
One of the big stories out of the Republican National Convention this week has been about Sarah Palin's, John McCain's vice presidential nominee. Her daughter, 17-year-old, is pregnant. And so there's been a lot of discussion, much fodder for the bloggers, many opinions back and forth, also triggering questions about mothers and fathers' responsibilities. Who's taking care of the children? Who should be taking care of the children? Is there equal responsibility? Tell us what you think, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But putting politics aside, the U.S. has the highest teen pregnancy rate among industrialized nations. That according to the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancies. To talk more about that, Patricia Quinn is joining us. She is the executive director of the Massachusetts Alliance of Teen Pregnancy. Good morning, Patricia. Thanks for being with us. And what are the estimates of teen pregnancy for this year here in the U.S.?
Well, teen pregnancy rates are estimated with a lot of data that is not available sort of in the moment. So we can't really give you rates of teen pregnancy for this year. And unfortunately, the most recent pregnancy rates that we have for the U.S. or for any state in the U.S. Come all the way back to 2000. We have more recent accurate birth rates. Go ahead.
So what do those numbers look like?
In terms of teen pregnancy rates in the U.S., we're looking at rates of about 84 per thousand in 2000. Now, the expectation is that the birth rate dropped during that period, so probably has the pregnancy rate. But as you stated at the top of the program, it's still the highest in the industrialized world and certainly unacceptable.
The CDC reports that one-third of girls will get pregnant by the time they're 20. Is that true?
It's a little bit shocking, isn't it? You think, how could that be? But, yeah, those are good statistics, and the national campaign also says that. You have to understand that that's throughout her life as a teen. So it's not in any one given year that that happens, but for every teenager, one in three will get pregnant before the age of 20.
Why are these numbers so high? What do you attribute them to?
Well, when we're looking at what teens need to prevent teen pregnancy, we're usually talking about three things. One is support for access to information about sexual health. Second is access to condoms and other contraceptives for sexually active youth. And then third is perception of opportunity and aspirations and plans for the future. And all three of those things are necessary. The first two are sort of the things people spend the most time talking about, and they're necessary, but they're not sufficient in and of themselves. Not to mention that we live in a very complex culture in regard to adolescent sexuality.
Well, let's think a little bit about the future, that sort of last category you talked about. I was talking with some teenage girls and women over the last couple of days, and every single one of them assumed without questioning that Bristol Palin was being forced to get married by her parents. Now, I have no idea if that's the case, and I don't want to suggest that that is the case, but that was their assumption. What is the prognosis for these kinds of marriages that take place in their teens after a pregnancy is already noted?
Well, I don't know a lot about the sort of outcome statistically for teen marriages. I do know that the overwhelming majority of pregnancies among teen couples are between unmarried couples, somewhere close to 90%.
Wow.
And in the U.S. overall, I think it's probably somewhere in the 80s in Massachusetts and in many states in the country. It's it's more than 90%.
You talked about three things being important when trying to deal with and confront these issues, but none of them included abstinence, which is something that the Bush administration has spent tens of millions of dollars on across the country.
Well, actually, you can find a lot of information about abstinence in almost every sexuality education curricula. There is a key part of comprehensive sexuality education is support for delaying sexual activity. And that's an important element that young people need to learn about and be encouraged to pursue. And there are a number of different proven effective sexuality education curricula and teen pregnancy prevention curricula that stress delaying sexual activity as a really important choice that young people can make. At the same time, when you look at the data in terms of what decisions young people are making, somewhere close to actually over 60% of U.S. high school students are sexually active at least have had sex at least once before they graduate. So we know that they do delay for periods of time, but that most young people do become sexually active while still in their teens.
Patricia, final question. As this issue has bubbled to the surface, what do you hope Americans learn most from the discussion?
Well, I would say there's two things. One, we need to understand the complexity of this issue, that all of the factors, individual, family, community, society, that impact young people's efforts to make healthy decisions. And then the second thing is that we have to come to terms with the fact that we don't get to decide for young people when they become sexually active or even when they become parents, but that we can ensure that they understand our values, our hopes for them, and that they have the information and support they need to be intentional about sexual decision-making.
Patricia Quinn, thank you. She is the executive director of the Massachusetts Alliance on Teen Pregnancy. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Vice President Dick Cheney is in Azerbaijan today for talks with top leaders. It's his first stop on a tour of several former Soviet republics, all key energy players. And Cheney heads to Georgia next, then on to Ukraine. Gustav just grazed New Orleans, but it's still dropping rain on parts of Texas and Louisiana today. New Orleans, who evacuated ahead of the storm, aren't allowed back into the city yet. Mayor Ray Nagin says authorities have set up roadblocks to stop residents from returning until it's safe. He says people can start to head home tomorrow. Pakistan's Prime Minister Yusuf Jilani is apparently safe right now after shots were fired at his motorcade today. A spokesman says that two bullets struck the limousine as it was traveling along a main road near Islamabad. And if you're in Chicago today, you might want to head down to the big downtown park. Oprah Winfrey even is giving Chicago a high-profile boost in its bid to host the 2016 Summer Olympics. She's taping her show in Chicago outside this afternoon. Invited on the guest list, 150 U.S. Olympic athletes, including Michael Phelps, Nassir Lukin, Kobe Bryant will be there.
That's Grant Park?
Yes.
A lot of wind there. They'll have to cover the microphones.
That's happening today, and you can see the show on Monday.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adoree Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Assassination attempt unsuccessful in Pakistan. The Prime Minister is safe, but it's another reminder of the violent struggle in that most unstable of countries. And the world's most deadliest place is in Pakistan, in the northwest of that country. Dexter Filkins has a piece in Sunday's New York Times magazine called Right at the Edge. The article is fascinating and alarming, and it's all about Waziristan and the northwest frontier province, that area that the Taliban appears to control, and where U.S. forces and Pakistani forces have at best a complicated and nuanced relationship. Dexter, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much.
Let's just get right to the point here. The question you ask at the top of your article is, whose side is Pakistan on? Why is it hard to tell in the battles with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in this part of Northwest Frontier Province?
Well, that's a pretty easy answer, and that is the military there, the Pakistan military, which has always been stronger than the government since Pakistan, was born in 1947. There are large parts of the military that have always supported the Taliban. I mean, they helped create the Taliban back in the 90s. And so they continued to do that, and it doesn't really matter what the civilians say. And that's basically the heart of it right there.
And Dexter, why is there this great support despite lots of pledges to the United States about cracking down on these militants?
Well, you have to understand what's happening there. The United States has given something like $10 billion to Pakistan since 2001 for, helping to support, its interest there in Afghanistan. But at the same time, the population in Pakistan is, by and large, very, very anti-American. And they feel like, every time the United States says, hey, can you go into the tribal areas and kill some Taliban for us, they feel like they're fighting our war for us. Hmm. And so there's a lot of resentment about it. And that's basically the dynamic. So when somebody like, whether it was President Musharraf, who of course just resigned, or the current civilian government, when they tell their military to do something, it's not really clear that the military wants to do it. And likewise, when the generals tell their colonels to do things, they don't really have a lot of confidence that all those things are going to be carried out. So it's a really, really fluid situation.
Well, you were in the zones controlled by the Taliban and actually spoke with some individuals under some, personal hazard to yourself. Do you believe that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda is there in that region?
Well, it's pretty clear they're there. I asked that very question of a number of people that I talked to, and I did. I went into the tribal areas. I met with some of the Taliban people, which was really, really tricky. It took a long time to negotiate. It was pretty dangerous. I got in and I got out in one piece, so I was happy to do that. But at one point, I had a really interesting conversation with a tribal leader from South Waziristan. And I asked him at one point, he described for me, he said, well, the Arabs are here because if you go into the bazaar, you can hear them speaking Arabic. And then he said at one point, but the important Arabs live in the mountains outside of town. And, of course, it's all a very mountainous region. And he said they have their very, very expensive Arabian horses that they've brought in. The local people carry food up to them. So it's absolutely fascinating conversation. And I asked
that's interesting, Dexter. It's often referred to, battlefields are often referred to as theaters of operation in military jargon. But theater is actually something that is literally taking place over in Pakistan. Can you describe what the Pakistan military does that's, shall we say, theatrical?
Yes, it is theater. I'll give you a quick example that was very dramatic. I was at the edge of the tribal areas. The military announced this big operation. We're going to crush the Taliban. We're going to push them back. And I waited a couple of days, and then I went into the tribal areas myself. I sort of dressed up like a local. And I drove in, and I met with the Taliban, a mile outside of town. And there were no military forces, no Pakistani military forces anywhere and nowhere. And there were giant headlines in the newspapers, decisive military operation begins. And I remember sitting there talking with this Taliban commander, And I said, well, what's going on? And he said, it's just theater. And I said, for who? And he said, for the Americans. And so, boy, you can imagine, that was a pretty bizarre conversation. So I had to kind of spend the rest of the, you know, month that I was there deconstructing them.
Did that Taliban commander know you were from the New York Times during that conversation?
He knew. I mean, it was, again, it took me weeks to arrange that. I had to make sure that he was not, I remember he said to me at one point, the biggest Taliban commander is a guy named Batullah Masood, and that's the area where they think Osama probably is hiding. And this Taliban commander said to me, the one I was talking to, Nandar, said to me, you know, Batullah Masood would cut your head off, so you've got to be careful about these things.
Indeed, Dexter, there are allegations that Masood was responsible for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Did you find anything out about that?
No, I didn't. But what was fascinating was the guy that I met with, the Taliban commander, who was a guy named Haji Namdar, who has sent hundreds of people across the border to fight the Americans in Afghanistan. He was killed. He was gunned down a few weeks after I talked to him. Not clear by whom. He was assassinated. It was very mysterious circumstances. So, you know, God only knows. It looks like it was Batullah Masood who did it. Because he's trying to take over the entire area by himself.
But he did tell you, Dexter, about incidences where his militants go back and forth with the approval of the Pakistani military attacking U.S. targets in Afghanistan.
Yes, he did. He did. I mean, I think at one point he did that. But at one point, I actually talked to people. Fighters who had gone across the border, fought, and then come back. And I remember in the conversation I had, the guy said, well, we had just destroyed these Afghan army posts, and we were walking back across the border. And we saw some, you know, Pakistani guards, and they gave us water, and we had a nice chat, and we went back across.
A nice chat, and we go back across. Dexter Filkins, New York Times correspondent, his story Right at the Edge about Northwest Frontier Province in Pakistan appears in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Vice President Dick Cheney is in oil-rich Azerbaijan before heading to Ukraine and the Republic of Georgia. His visit is a not-so-subtle hint that the U.S. has come down firmly on Georgia's side following its war with Russia that broke out last month. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin takes center stage tonight. She will accept the Republican Party's vice presidential nod at the convention in St. Paul. And Mayor Ray Nagin says that New Orleans evacuees can go home tomorrow, but he set up checkpoints on the roads into the city to make sure his orders are followed. That's a look at your main news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. After President Bush spoke last night at the official opening of the Republican convention, and after former Senator Fred Thompson took to the podium, another familiar voice stepped up, a former Democratic vice presidential nominee.
You may be thinking of voting for John McCain, but you're not sure yet. Some of you may never have voted for a Republican before. And frankly, in an ordinary election, you probably never would. But I want you to believe with me that this is no ordinary election. And it's no ordinary election because these are not ordinary times. And trust me, John McCain is no ordinary candidate.
No ordinary campaign. This year in 2008, Joe Lieberman, the senator from Connecticut, has made it to prime time on the Republican marquee. He's been through a lot the last 8 years. After losing a Democratic primary in his state, he switched parties, becoming an independent, though technically an independent Democrat. Still, though, today he's backing the Republican McCain-Palin ticket for president. And if politics are usually a straight line, Lieberman's path has been a curved one since the 2000 Democratic nomination and convention in Los Angeles, when he talked about the not-so-beloved Republicans then who were convening in Philadelphia.
Our opponents are decent, and they are likable men. I'm proud to call many in their party my friends, but America must understand there are very real differences between us in this election. 2 weeks ago, our Republican friends actually try to walk and talk a lot like us. Did you notice? Yeah. But let's be honest about this. We may be near Hollywood tonight, but not since Tom Hanks won an Oscar has there been that much acting in Philadelphia.
Times have changed, but even back then in 2000, among those Republican friends Lieberman referred to, he wished John McCain well, as McCain in 2000 was battling skin cancer.
As my dear friend John McCain might say, and let me say, great man John McCain, you are in our prayers here in this hall tonight. You're a great fighter, and you're going to win the fight you're waging now. As John McCain might say, let me do a little straight talking right now.
Today, that friendship has blossomed beyond borrowing words. Today, it means political support, perhaps not just about politics, but friendship too.
So tonight, I want to ask you whether you are an independent, a Reagan Democrat, a Clinton Democrat, or just a plain old Democrat. This year, when you vote for president, vote for the person you believe is best for our country, not for the party you happen to belong to.
That's former Democratic vice presidential candidate Joe Lieberman coaxing, hoping to coax some of his former Democrats to take another look at McCain. Even better yet, coax some of his fellow independents to give McCain a chance.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's time for some headlines from Femi. Okay. Hey, Femi.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. The country will hear from John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, tonight for the first time since he introduced her at a rally last week. Palin will accept a spot on the ticket with McCain at the Republican convention. President Bush, Fred Thompson, and Joe Lieberman were among those to address delegates at the Republican convention last night. Lieberman, a strong backer of the Iraq war, says that John McCain stood with courage, but Barack Obama voted to cut off funding for troops. Embattled Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko says his rival prime minister and opposition parties have attempted a constitutional coup. The opposition yesterday passed a law that cuts the president's power and boosts the prime minister's. Yushchenko is calling for a new coalition government. And he was the trailer king, Thunderthroat, the voice of God, or the highest paid movie trailer narrator in Hollywood. Don LaFontaine, the voice of movie trailers, has died. LaFontaine became famous for his distinct voice and a particular catchphrase.
In a world where both of our cars were totally underwater.
That was from a Geico advert just a few years ago. Don's agent, Ilko Drozdowski, said that LaFontaine was responsible for lots of movie catchphrases.
In a world without heroes, you know, a young boy finds love. All these very emotional phrases, catchlines, as it were, he brought to the forefront. And right now they're imitated, copied, and parodied and recycled over and over and over, I'm afraid.
And LaFontaine made more than 5,000 movie trailers. Adoring John, if you mention a movie trailer, he probably did it.
In a world without LaFontaine, what will Hollywood do?
I know, he has such a distinctive voice.
And he said he didn't mind that people didn't know his name or his face, that they just knew his voice, or he was the movie trailer guy.
He was the movie trailer guy.
Hollywood's going to miss him.
Yeah, died yesterday. Monday, excuse me, 68.
Thanks, Femi.
You're
we're going to head back to St. Paul, Minnesota, where Republican Ron Paul, well, he's also there in the Twin Cities, though he made a splash in the primaries and even broke some online fundraising records. He won't be celebrating with his party at the GOP official event. He's holding his own counter convention.
Resisting the temptation of power requires some strength, and we don't need more government power.
The former long-shot candidate for the Republican nomination held his event across the river from the GOP's official event. And as you can imagine, the two gatherings could not be more different. Takeaway contributor and Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner was there last night. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Adora.
Set the scene for us here. What did the Ron Paul convention, what did it look, feel like?
Honestly, if you walked in or you landed from Mars, you'd never know the guy lost anything. It was a party. It was incredibly celebratory and triumphal, especially when you compare it to the GOP convention, which was not a downer by any stretch, but you'd never know that their candidate, Ron Paul, had lost. Furthermore, you'd never know that his supporters didn't represent the hearts and minds of most Americans. In other words, it felt as though they were a majority that couldn't figure out why the minority hadn't gotten on the program, gotten with the program, whereas in fact they represent what the Republican Party sees as a fringe.
And how many people are you talking about, and how many speeches were there last night, and what were they talking about that felt so celebratory?
So there were a lot of speeches. It was a day-long event. Estimates are probably about 10,000. Could have been more. I wasn't there for the end when it really filled up. The speeches were from, I guess you would call them the kind of heart of the libertarian establishment, as far as that goes. And the celebrations and really the points of interest and the points of rally were extraordinarily different than what you'd hear at a typical convention, at a typical political convention. So it's a little bit weird, right? It feels like a real convention. There are signs for the delegates from different states. They're homemade signs. Everything's a little bit homemade feeling. They're running it a little bit like a convention, but it's actually a rally. And the points that they're rallying about are what they see as the points of the Republican Party, right? So they see themselves as the last gasp of the true Republican Party, whereas, again, they're seen as more of a fringe by the GOP. Don't forget, their candidate was not invited to speak at the GOP convention. He says he happily would have. So the things that are being celebrated at this convention, the single most common and most vigorous chant of the day was end the Fed, right? Getting rid of the Federal Reserve is not the kind of business that's conducted at the GOP convention or the Democratic convention.
I was just going to say, I have a feeling that I don't think that chant was said over and over again over in St. Paul at the GOP convention.
Get rid of the Federal Reserve. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
It was not.
Yes, we can.
You know, Grover Norquist, who is president of Americans for Tax Reform, which essentially wants to get rid of taxes, income taxes, and he's also on the board of the NRA, he began with a line that, again, sets people on fire. Let me summarize, he says. Taxes bad, guns good. And in some ways, it was as simple as that. In a lot of other ways, though, it's a complex argument they're making. They're making the argument that the country was fantastic about 230 years ago, and it's gone mostly downhill from there.
Huh. I'm not sure I would have wanted to have lived 230 years ago, but that's just me. Let's compare that. I wouldn't have had some guns.
230
you see.
Years ago? Yeah, you would have.
No, I don't think so. I think I would have been enslaved. It was called slavery. Anyhow, Stephen, how did that compare to what was going on at the GOP convention?
Well, as you've already heard today, and as you'll hear a lot more, the big lines there were much more traditional. I did go around asking delegates at the GOP convention later in the day. I asked them, what's a single task you would want a President McCain to begin to accomplish or to attack, at least, from day one if he's elected?
You know, I think the biggest thing for me right now is the war.
Once elected, I want him to continue his strength with the security issues. Terrorism.
The economy.
There are so many things.
I think the energy issue.
Energy.
Wind, nuclear, and incentives for the industry to head in that direction.
Drill now, drill now, drill now.
Very good.
Huh, so energy was right there at the top of the list for people.
Energy was right there at the top of the list. You know, yes and no. So here's what's interesting to me about it. Energy is plainly a buzzword and much more than that, right? The problem is this. The minute you ask the next question about energy, what would you like done? What are your dreams? What does an energy plan look like? And this is not to cast aspersions on anyone I talk to, delegates or otherwise, but the problem is the answer to that is an incredibly complex answer, and that's because energy itself is complex. It comprises technology and geology and engineering, all this. The problem is politics, as we see more and more, is incredibly not complex. It just does not deal with complexity well.
Well, but would you say that the Ron Paul convention is an attempt to really try to deal with substantive issues that are complex that might not make their way onto a sort of soundbite-driven national convention stage?
I would say yes in a kind of wonkish way, in a kind of theoretical way. One of the biggest applause lines at the Ron Paul convention was when someone praised the Austrian School of Economic Thought. And people explode, because what that means is liberty of a financial, monetary, and, you know, personal liberty way. That is not, that's not the same message that we're hearing here at the GOP convention. The energy point that I want to raise is this. You know, Gerald Ford agreed 30 years ago, sounding like an economist, that we should let gas prices rise to drive down demand and incentivize alternatives, right? That is such a dead issue now. In other words, as much as Republicans and everyone want to tackle the energy issue, the problem is that right now what we're seeing is that higher gas prices are actually driving down demand, but we hate that because as an economic issue, it's a non-starter with the electorate.
So the discussion then was really quite different at the two. In other words, over at Ron Paul's, they were talking about big, broad issues. And over at the GOP convention, at least last night with the delegates you were speaking with, they were talking about one particular issue but not addressing some of the complexities of it.
Not that this was the forum to address the complexities of it, right? But what I will say is this. The Ron Paul people seemed extremely happy. The Republicans seemed prepared and moving forward. But, you know, it's not that they have no reason to feel triumphal. It's just that, look, they have a lot more stress on them. They're in the middle of a race that they may very well win, but they could also lose it.
There's our Stephen Dubner, our Takeaway Convention correspondent, co-author of Freakonomics and the Freakonomics blog at the New York Times website.
Austrian School of Economic Thought. I didn't know Dubner spoke Austrian.
You've been fixated on that ever since he mentioned that.
I love it. It's so interesting. You get your Takeaway Fix on Twitter, friend feed, Facebook, and, of course, at thetakeaway.org.
On today's show, we're following the Republican convention and the one by Ron Paul, too. We're also talking about teenage pregnancy in the wake of the news about Bristol Palin. But some of you wish we wouldn't talk about it anymore.
My name is Stephanie, and I live in Florida. The economy, the deficit, the lies in Iraq are more important than being bogged down with the Republican and their double standard for Dick Cheney's children and Sarah Palin's children.
There's a point of view. We'd love to get all of them. Leave us a message on our Spinbox line, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's the takeaway. Yo, Dexter.
The military there, the Pakistan military, which has always been stronger than the government since Pakistan, you know, was born in 1947.
That's Dexter Filkins from the New York Times correspondent talking about Pakistan. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Luke Skywalker, who's your daddy?
I am your father.
No. No. It's not true. That's impossible. No! No!
Occasionally, children make it difficult for their high-profile parents. Political progeny? It's a good thing, right? Well, if the force be with you, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 3rd, and I'm just going to leave that one alone, John. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Adora.
And today, we're going to take a look at the Republicans who are back in full swing at their national convention. We have a report from St. Paul. Oil, the price per barrel has plummeted. Why? We'll take a look at that. Also, Vice President Dick Cheney is not with the party faithful in Minnesota. He's visiting former Soviet republics. Also, vetting vice presidential candidates, there's a long history of both successes and failures. Those stories are coming up, but first these headlines.
Back to politics as usual last night at the RNC after Monday's restrained kickoff in St. Paul. A stream of speakers took the stage to praise John McCain and blast Barack Obama, including the First Lady and President Bush. Senator Fred Thompson, went on the attack.
The Democrats present a history-making nominee for president. History-making in that he's the most liberal, most inexperienced nominee to ever run for president.
Little history in that a Democrat, Joe Lieberman, addressed the convention and gave John McCain a glowing endorsement. Sarah Palin, McCain's Veep pick, is behind the podium tonight. It's her first public speech since she revealed her 17-year-old daughter is 5 months pregnant. Vice President Cheney is in Azerbaijan today. It's his first stop on a tour of former Soviet republics. He's also heading to Georgia and Ukraine. All three countries are key players in the oil industry. The U.S. visit perhaps signals support for the region in the face of increasing Russian dominance.
And it looks like Georgia will be getting more than just a visit from Dick Cheney. Later today, the White House is expected to pledge more than $1 billion in aid for the Republic to be delivered over the next several years. Gustav is not a hurricane anymore, but it's still drenching parts of Texas and Louisiana. Thousands of New Orleans residents who evacuated ahead of the storm are still in shelters. Mayor Ray Nagin says they'll be able to go home soon.
It's been a couple of days now. We promised them that we would bring them back within days and not weeks, and I want to honor that promise.
Nagin says they can start heading back tomorrow.
After encouragement from the Kremlin, North Korea is back at work on its nuclear program, reportedly. In politics, Barack Obama is in Ohio talking about the economy. John McCain arrives in St. Paul this afternoon. Oil prices slipped below $108 a barrel in Asia. In Western trading, they're down more than a dollar and a half. The markets are set to open slightly down. The S&P begins trading today at 1277. But on our minds is the question of, is there a double standard when a woman enters politics at the level of Sarah Palin?
And is some of the criticism of her, perhaps as a parent, is that fair? Is that fair to judge her that harshly? Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Can't she be a good mom and a solid professional at the same time? Why not?
What is the level of responsibility for kids because of your gender? On The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Today, a U.S. Navy ship loaded with humanitarian aid steamed through the Dardanelles toward the Republic of Georgia as the Bush administration prepared to roll out a $1 billion economic aid package for the ex-Soviet Republic. Vice President Dick Cheney is due to arrive in Georgia on Thursday, but today he is in oil-rich Azerbaijan. The tour aims to show Washington's support of Russia's southern neighbors. Steve Rosenberg is the BBC's Moscow correspondent, comes to us from Moscow. Hello, Stephen, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So what is the message Vice President Dick Cheney is sending to Moscow?
Well, I think, first of all, Dick Cheney is sending a message to America's allies in Russia's backyard. That is that America, Washington, will continue to support Ukraine and Georgia and Azerbaijan. But I think really this visit is all about geopolitics and all about oil and gas. I think the geopolitics are very simple. Azerbaijan has massive reserves of oil and natural gas, reserves that America and Europe want to tap. They want to pump them west via Georgia, bypassing Russia, so that the West can be less reliant on Russian energy. And I think there is concern in Washington at the moment, following the violence in the Caucasus, that those reserves are under threat, and that Azerbaijan could feel itself pressured into turning its back on the West and to getting a deal on energy with the Kremlin instead. So I think that's why Dick Cheney has gone to Baku. But even if he succeeds there, he still has a major problem in Georgia, because Georgia was selected by the West as a safe transit point for these pipelines going west to bypass Russia. Well, the conflict that we saw last month has shown that Georgia is anything but safe and stable. So that is a major headache for the West.
And not only that, but the Kremlin has made it abundantly clear that it not only resents the U.S. backing of these areas, but potentially might do something in retaliation.
I think over the last few years, the Kremlin has got increasingly irritated as it has seen Western influence grow and get closer to its borders. You know, the Kremlin has watched as NATO has expanded up to Russia's eastern borders. Even former Soviet states like Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia are now members of NATO. And NATO has promised to make Ukraine and Georgia one day members of NATO. Russia has sat back and seen the United States make an agreement with Poland and the Czech Republic about a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. And Russia, I think, has drawn a red line in the sand now and is determined to defend what it sees as its sphere of influence in the former Soviet space, and is making it clear that, you know, as far as oil and gas is concerned, Russia is determined to battle all the way to make sure that all the pipelines from the Caspian go through Russia.
Well, Steve, there are red lines, and then there are, as you point out, pipelines. The EU had as its theme in the summit that took place just a few days ago, you know, the issue of getting an alternative pipeline that bypasses Russia. Do you see Cheney's visit to Azerbaijan as an extension of what was discussed at the EU summit, or much more of an independent initiative?
I think it is an independent initiative. I think you're right that European leaders did mention the idea of diversifying their energy sources so that they're not reliant on Russia. But that's going to take a very long time. And I think the Russians feel very confident about their position. They know that Europe at the moment is reliant on Russian oil and gas. And they feel that America also needs Russia's help for a whole range of issues. So I think in what's become this rather complicated but dramatic geopolitical game, Moscow is feeling very confident indeed.
Well, but the flip side of that, too, is, though, doesn't Russia need these international markets as well?
Well, that's often said by economists and politicians in the West. If you say that to someone in the Russian government, they'll shrug their shoulders and say, look, we can sell our oil and gas to China. And Russia is in the process of building new pipelines to China. So the Russians are very bullish indeed.
And Stephen, has there been a specific response to Dick Cheney's trip, his arrival in the region, by the Kremlin?
No, not really. One Russian foreign ministry official said, well, we'll have to wait and see what Dick Cheney says once he gets to Georgia, but hinting that his presence there didn't help the stability in the region. We haven't had much more reaction than that.
Here's a question, Steve. You don't even have to respond to this if you don't want to. I mean, there's the possibility that Dick Cheney, outgoing vice president, is actually looking for a job, right?
Well, you know, when the German chancellor, the former German chancellor, Gerhard Schroeder, was looking for a job, he found one very quickly with Gazprom.
There's a takeaway for you. Thanks very much. Steve Rosenberg is the BBC's Moscow correspondent. John?
All this bears directly on the price of oil. And another day, another five-month low, oil has fallen to near $108 a barrel. It's actually just above $108. But Brent crude is at $107. Concerns about slowing global demand are part of it. Hurricane Gustav is also a factor. And a stronger dollar is pushing the oil prices lower. Nick McGregor is an energy analyst for the stockbroker Redmain Bentley. He joins us from London. Nick, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Hi.
It seems to me, I want to talk about all of this, but it seems to me the Gustav issue, let's isolate that for a moment. It seems with the giant drop and, you know, even a buildup as Gustav was approaching the Gulf, there was a spike There's a sign that speculators are trading on weather, which is relatively unusual, it seems to me. Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element of that, but I also think that because the potential impact Gustav could have had was so vast and it was such an unknown, there was a degree of people who had short positions closing them ahead of Gustav and so on. So I think it was partly down to people speculating on the weather and partly down to people just deciding that they wanted to be flat on any oil positions ahead of Gustav to lend you what was happening.
But does that explain an almost $10 a barrel drop? Following once it was clear that Gustav was not going to be that big of a factor?
Well, at the same time, we saw several other things happening. I don't think Gustav explains all of it, but we saw continuing strength in the US dollar. We've seen the situation in the Caucasus in Georgia and so on a little bit more amenable between the Russians and the EU. And we've seen continued sort of fairly mediocre economic data, the OECD report into the strength of European economies and so on. So I think those things have come together to give us that $10 drop.
Well, as oil prices began to spike around 140, even higher than that, dollars a barrel, there was all this talk from the White House and from European capitals that, you know, OPEC should do something to control or stabilize the price of oil. Mm-hmm. Now there's some discussion that OPEC might actually do a production cut to try to stabilize the price of oil on the southern side of the ticker. Do you think OPEC actually has the power to do that at this point, or are we going farther south no matter what?
Well, OPEC meets next week. And while, as you say, there's been a lot of talk that they might now try and put the brakes on, the problem with production cuts is when it was rising, everyone's concern was whether or not they could increase production, even if they wanted to. And a lot of the peak oil theorists saying they can't. Now we know that we can do, you know, we can produce at the levels we've seen recently. Even if they cut production, it's a fairly blunt instrument. And the biggest thing that's going to move oil markets isn't whether or not OPEC are producing, it's whether or not the world demands the stuff. And that's the big equation at the moment, that the concern about falling demand is probably going to mean even a production cut isn't going to put the brakes on and send us back to $147, no.
So demand is falling faster than even OPEC can cut. Where is the demand falling? We've got Asia, we've got Europe, we've got the United States. So lay it out for us.
Pretty well across the board, and it's all relative. While we're seeing demand, for example, increasing in China and India, and these, of course, were the areas that were meant to be taking up the slack as Western economies slowed down, we've seen over the last couple of months early indications that in those areas, while demand grows, it's not growing as fast as previously thought. And therefore, again, we might see some slack in what have been a very, very tight market. I think that the other thing that is part of the issue is that we're seeing some of the investments that have been made over the last few years starting to get closer to fruition. So production's likely to increase over the next couple of years as well. And that's given people a little bit more of a calming effect.
Finally, is the dollar, the rising dollar, a wild card in this, or does it help us to actually predict the trend one way or another?
It's certainly a wild card. I mean, the rising dollar helps from the balance of payments point of view for the USA, which in turn will help the dollar strengthen. So it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. The biggest impact in the short term from the point of view of the rising dollar is the effect it's had on speculative money, a lot of which was in the oil market primarily as a dollar hedge. Rising dollar, falling oil price, it makes that play a non-starter now. And a lot of that speculative money has moved away, and that's been behind a fair degree of the fall we've seen so far.
And that's probably a good thing. Speculators out, less volatility, price stabilizes, good for consumers. Nick McGregor, thanks so much.
Cheers.
Nick McGregor is energy analyst for the stockbroker Redmayne Bentley. He joined us from London.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 3rd, and Sarah Palin, John McCain's VP pick, John, she's certainly been taking a lot of heat, huh?
Oh, vetting, comedy, butt of jokes, it's material.
Everyone's got an opinion.
Is it politically
about an opinion
useful?
About her as a politician, an opinion about her as a parent? What do you think? She being judged fairly or unfairly? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Tonight is her big night, though. She will be giving a major national speech at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. And for many, it will be the first time that they'll ever heard her speak. This morning, she spent a few minutes standing on the stage, taking a look out at where her teleprompter will be and some other things. And meanwhile, the questions continue as to whether or not she was properly vetted before the McCain campaign picked her. And for a look at history, we're going to turn now to Vice Presidential expert Joel Goldstein. He's a law professor at St. Louis University and author of The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution. We thought a good person to talk to. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
So let's talk about transformation. You've been studying vice presidential candidates for decades. Where does Palin's nomination and what we know about her vetting, how does that stack up among the rest?
Well, it's a different sort of nomination. If you look at the people who've been chosen to be vice presidential candidates in over the last 50 years or so, almost all of them have had much more extensive governmental experience than she has had, or have had previous experience running for president, have been in the national eye before. We've never before had a candidate who had so little prior experience in high governmental position as Governor Palin.
Let's talk about the vetting process itself.
Sure.
I was really surprised when I was looking at some of the notes from your book that the process, you say, really began with Jimmy Carter. How has it developed since then?
Sure. It did begin really in 1976, was when both the presidential nominees on the Democratic and Republican side really began the sort of process we have since then. It really began in 1976, with a relatively short questionnaire. The Democratic questionnaire was less than 20 questions in 1976, which Governor Carter asked half a dozen finalists to respond to. Now I saw that the Republican questionnaire included 70 questions, and sometimes they're longer than that. It's a process that is very intrusive in terms of trying to learn everything there is to know about the finalists before a decision's made.
Generally, up till now, up to this Palin nomination, you say it's a very intense process. I mean, describe it to us. I think you've got an example about Chuck Hagel. How long did it go on? What did it entail?
Well, there usually are different stages to it. I mean, one stage is trying to find out information that's in the public record. What can you learn from Googling somebody? What can you learn from looking at government sources about them? And then, generally speaking, when a decision is made as to who are the finalists, there's usually a questionnaire that may take the person really a lot of time and effort to complete. I mean, and Senator Hagel was one of the people that then Governor George Bush considered for his running mate in 2000. He said he spent about 2 weeks completing the questionnaire. It involved getting his lawyers, his accountants, his business partners involved. I mean, people send boxes of material into the campaign, financial records and so forth. And then the vetting process usually includes talking to other political figures, other people who might know the potential nominee to find out what they can learn that way.
It doesn't sound like it's very much fun at all. Is all of this a reaction to the 1972 fiasco with George McGovern and Tom Eagleton?
To some extent it is, in the sense that Senator McGovern really didn't do any vetting. They never asked Senator Eagleton any questions about his health. And it was all done at the last minute. There was also the whole experience with Spiro Agnew, having served as vice president, and then after having been elected twice, there was the investigation that that disclosed that he had accepted bribes as governor of Maryland and then as vice president from contractors.
And he eventually pleaded noli contendere, and that was the end of him. Of course, Thomas Eagleton had the mental health problems, which ended his role as a running mate.
And finally, quickly, last question for you, Joel. Obviously, we don't know everything that led up to the Sarah Palin nomination, but it certainly sounds from what we've read, for example, that McCain only met with her the day before he actually nominated her. What do you think, how do you think that will impact her place?
Well, I think in a couple ways. I mean, if more things come out about her that prove damaging, it could jeopardize her position. It could also reflect on Senator McCain, both in terms of judgment and in terms of how the process was run. I guess the two things that seem a little bit unusual about it are, one, that there was relatively little contact between the two of them before the choice was made, which seems to be a bit unusual in situations where the candidate doesn't know the prospective running mate. The other thing was that it doesn't seem as if they had time to really talk to people in Alaska and find out about her, so that while they clearly talked to her and apparently she filled out the questionnaire,
right,
the indications are that they didn't have time, because Senator McCain came to the decision relatively late in the process to interview people in Alaska.
Perhaps rushed, perhaps not. Joel Goldstein, thank you very much, law professor at St. Louis University and the author of The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution. And now we're going to head to Femi Oke, who's got a few headlines for us. Femi?
Thanks, Ajoy. It is 29 minutes past the hour. Yesterday's speeches at the Republican National Convention highlighted John McCain as a war hero. And today, Sarah Palin will speak and accept her VP nomination. Rudy Giuliani will give the keynote address. Pakistan's Prime Minister Yusuf Jilani has escaped what authorities are calling an assassination attempt. Shots were fired at his motorcade on a road near Islamabad today. And more from Pakistan, where officials are furious over a cross-border raid from neighbouring Afghanistan. Authorities say that US-led coalition forces touched down near a village and attacked. Pakistan says that several civilians were killed in the raid. And Vice President Dick Cheney is in Azerbaijan today for talks with top leaders. It's his first stop on a tour of several former Soviet republics, and they're all key energy players. That's a look at your main news headlines for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
As you gather tonight in St. Paul, I want to share some thoughts about our nominee, a great American, and the next president of the United States, John McCain.
Good morning. Of course, that's President Bush speaking at the Republican National Convention last night. And you kind of have to ask yourself the question, what were they thinking when they sat down to work out a script for this week's convention in St. Paul? They probably couldn't have predicted that among the headlines would be teen pregnancy, Hurricane Katrina being remembered by a new hurricane, Hurricane Gustav. Well, if you look at the convention this week, you see a party that is in transition, struggling to focus on its message amidst all the headlines, and to find a message that's going to project it from now until November. Joining us now is New York Times reporter Adam Nagorny. He's in St. Paul. We're going to talk with him about the effectiveness of the Republican message, actually to find out what it is. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You know, it feels as though the Republicans have decided to shift gears more than just to accommodate Hurricane Gustav. It seems there are a lot of issues in play here. How effective have the Republicans been in sort of jumping tracks here and moving on to a whole different set of messages?
Well, look, the Republicans had two tasks coming in here. The first one was to try to draw contrasts with Senator Barack Obama. And the second was to try to make the case for Senator McCain. Two things have gotten in the way. One is they lost Monday night because of the hurricane, even though I would argue they made the best of that by canceling it and doing events around the hurricane. And the other is that at least for the first 2 days of the convention, it's been about the McCain campaign making the case for Governor Palin and why that was a good choice. Now, again, if we were having this conversation last week, there were some people that were saying that the Democratic convention was kind of a fizzle and not going well, and clearly that turned around in the last 2 days. So we have Governor Palin speaking tonight. We have Mayor Giuliani speaking tonight. We have Senator McCain speaking Thursday night. So there's time for them to turn around. But, you know, it's obviously been a slow beginning and not the beginning they were hoping for.
Well, let's extract two messages at least that were showcased at the podium last night. Here's President Bush, who actually wasn't at the podium. He was on screen talking about John McCain's war record.
If the Hanoi Hilton could not break John McCain's resolve to do what is best for his country, you can be sure the angry left never will.
So it's the angry left versus John McCain. Do you think that plays?
I think that plays with the base. I mean, the thing to remember about the conventions here is that there are two audiences. There's the primetime audience, the people across the country who are watching it, and there's the people inside the hall. And people inside the hall plus base people who are watching it outside, I think they do react to stuff like that, and they react to the sort of the attacks on the media that we heard last night and the angry left, which I think is a phrase, as I recall, that Bush people used in 2004. I think for the general public, the more important theme there was presenting, you know, McCain as this sort of war hero who will put his country first. I mean, I think that's the main theme that we're hearing, and that will be the main sort of way they're going to try to sort of promote Senator McCain and draw a distinction with Senator Obama.
Well, then surely this message from Senator Joe Lieberman, a Democrat who spoke last night, is also aimed outside the convention hall to the American electorate at large. Listen.
I'm here to support John McCain because country matters more than party.
Of course, Lieberman personifies that. How do you think that issue of McCain as the nonpartisan plays?
I think it might have played better a year ago than it plays now. I think that to some extent McCain has lost that as the race has become more partisan, and that is one of the costs that he's had to pay by making the decision to attack Obama more. But, you know, that has always been Senator McCain's brand, if you will. So I think that's sort of a powerful issue for him. Whether Senator Lieberman is the best person to make that case, I'm not sure. My guess is, and this is just totally gut, I have no idea, but my guess is that he doesn't have a lot of sway with Democrats these days. Independent voters, maybe, but I think Democrats, I don't think people view him as, I don't think people will march with him down any kind of path here.
So Sarah Palin speaks tonight. She's actually up, or at least within the last few minutes, she was up on the podium sort of checking her mic for her speech tonight at the convention. Based on the issues that you've already talked about, is it better for her to just say, look, this is my family, these are my values, leave me alone? Or does she have to do something to get the focus off of her tonight?
I mean, I think she really has to sort of reassure people that she is ready, A, to be a candidate to run for president, and B, to run for president. People do not know her. People, the public don't know her. You know, you walk around the hall, no one knows her except for the most insider Republicans. So I think her main task is just to reassure people that this governor of 2 years from Alaska, where there's been all these questions raised about how extensively John McCain and his campaign really vetted her, was she really the sort of last-minute choice? She needs to sort of reassure people that she is up to this kind of job. You know, I'm sure you can just do it with a speech, but we'll see.
Yeah, and as you say, conventions have a way of pulling out the most exciting moments at the very end while lowering expectations early on. Adam Nagorny, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Adam Nagorny, New York Times reporter. I wonder if Sarah Palin will mention the fact that she was commander-in-chief of the Alaska National Guard, like the McCain spinners were doing last night.
Oh, I'm sure she will. She did when she accepted the nomination and stood with John McCain last Friday. Yeah. She certainly didn't mention that.
Be very interesting. And now, headlines from Femi Okay.
I was controller of the Rose Patrol in Girl Guides, the first South Bassey Girl Guides troop. Does that count?
Are you a general? Are you a lieutenant?
What I was the guide leader.
Do we salute you?
Do I have enough experience to do this job, do you think?
No. No, get a little more experience now, why don't you?
Okay, all right, here we go. 21 minutes to the hour, good morning. Frustrated residents from New Orleans who left the city before Hurricane Gustave hit want to return home, but Mayor Ray Nagin says not quite yet. Evacuee Terry Hammer is staying in a shelter and conditions are becoming uncomfortable.
As far as the people are concerned here, they're great. They're doing what they can do for us. They feed us. They're housing us. But we have no showers, no way to clean yourself up. And it's really getting, pretty nasty up in there.
Mayor Nagin has set up checkpoints to prevent residents from returning home until Thursday. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin takes center stage tonight. She will accept the Republican Party's vice presidential nod at the convention in St. Paul. And just across the river from the Republican convention in St. Paul, thousands of Ron Paul supporters have been attending his rally for the Republic. The former Republican presidential candidate explains why he was holding a separate gathering.
We want to present our case in a very positive way and not worry about what we didn't get. Instead of complaining about the media and complaining about the party, we have still enough freedom in this country to get involved and become the party.
So Ron Paul was not in St. Paul.
He was across the
across
river.
Across the river.
Just across the river on the
St. Paul, not Ron Paul.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, thanks for my attention to that.
Minneapolis.
Right, Minneapolis.
Just to put a fine point on it.
And Ron is not a saint, as far as we know.
Sorry, Femi.
As far as I know, he's not. But those thousands of supporters may well actually disagree with you.
You see the U.S. Open last night?
Ah, I didn't, but you did. How did it go?
Well, Roger Federer went to five sets last night. He's having a rough open, but he was winning last night. He was loving it.
Venus and Serena play later today.
That's your favorite match.
I do. I know. The sisters. I like them.
Thank you, Commander. Okay.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And we have delightfully unusual names, Adora. But
we do. You mean you and me?
Yeah, you and me. That's right.
Really? John Hockenberry's unusual?
Well, but there was a time when I thought Hockenberry was a strange name. And the Berry part produced some little kid jokes. But I can think of no alternative. But
what kind of jokes?
Hock to Berry. Kids can be cruel. Let's just put it that way. But hey, if you have a dreadfully strange name like Chad Johnson, if you're a wide receiver for the Cincinnati Bengals, what do? Well, you take the name of the number on your football jersey.
I'm back. I'm finna let it rip. My name ain't Chad no more. We celebrating Spanish Heritage Month, like the month of October in the NFL. Ocho Cinco from now on. Anybody that writes about whatever I say today, you call me Ocho Cinco. Do not say Chad. You're gonna get a pay cut. I'm not playing.
That's right. Ocho Cinco, 8-5. Ocho Cinco actually translates to 8-5 rather than 85, which is on his jersey. But hopefully he's not planning on getting any tattoos in other languages. But here, this is a serious question, the name business. You can't be a movie star, obviously, if your name is Marion Michael Morrison.
Good evening. My name's Wayne. Some of you may have seen me before. I hope so. I've been kicking around Hollywood a long time. I've made a lot of pictures out here. All kinds.
All kinds of pictures, John Wayne. So here's another one. Which is better, Archibald Leach or Cary Grant, star of Alfred Hitchcock's film
Cary Grant.
North by Northwest?
Jack Phillips, Western Sales Manager for Kingby Electronics.
No, you're not. You're Roger Thornhill of Madison Avenue, and you're wanted for murder on every front page in America. And don't be so modest.
I think Cary Grant made the right decision. Now, try this.
Yeah.
Guess the professional names of John Euler Lemon III, Bernard Schwartz, and Norma Jean Baker.
You're the replacement for the bass and sax?
That's us. And I'm Daphne. This is Joe Zavine.
I'm Sugar Kane.
Hi. Sugar Kane?
Yeah, I changed it. Used to be Sugar Kowalczyk.
Polish?
Yes.
And, of course, Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, and Marilyn Monroe in Some Like It Hot. And do you know who little boy Isur Danielovich Dembski grew up to become?
I'm Spartacus!
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 Spartacus? No, 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 no. Kirk Douglas. Now, try this. You know him as President Bartlett, but Martin Sheen's mother knew him as Ramon Antonio Gerard Estevez.
Thanks a lot. I wish I could spend more than a few minutes with you, but the polls don't close in the East for another hour, and there are plenty of election results still left to falsify.
Lots of name changes in music. Prince Rogers Nelson became Prince when he rode the top of the charts. Then he dropped Prince to just become the artist formerly known as Prince. How about Sean John Combs?
You a big cat, where your chicks at? Where your whips at? Wherever you get stacks, I'ma fix that. Everything that's...
He went from Puff Daddy to P. Diddy. Now he's just Sean John. And Curtis James Jackson III? That's not a hip-hop name. Fifty Cent, much, much better. What's your name change? Let us know on our spin box line, 877-8 my takeaway, my take, or leave a message on thetakeaway.org. We could have talked about Sting, Bob Dylan,
but Kirk Douglas. That name is... I'm still lost on that one.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Wednesday, September 3rd. We have some headlines for you from Femi Okay. Hey, Femi.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin steps into the limelight at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul tonight. She'll accept her party's nomination for vice president. And this is her first public address since it came to light that her 17-year-old daughter is pregnant. President Bush, Senator Joe Lieberman, and Fred Thompson mounted a verbal offensive against Barack Obama at the Republican convention in St. Paul last night. Speakers touted McCain's military service record while painting Obama as an untested liberal. Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm will preside over a state hearing to determine the fate of Detroit's Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick is accused of misleading the city council when he settled lawsuits with former police officers for more than $8 million. And tonight at the Republican convention, delegates will be raising McCain thanks to John Rich. And Rich will be performing Raising McCain, the song he wrote especially for Senator McCain. He says that he can't quite believe he's been invited to play at the convention. When you're a redneck country singer from Texas, you're not used to being allowed inside the real inner circle. I defy anybody not to dance like a crazy person to that song. You'll be hearing it if you're watching the convention tonight.
Thank you very much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
And still questions about the vetting of Sarah Palin as John McCain's VP running mate. And we asked for some of your thoughts, and we got some.
Hi, Kevin from New York calling. I find it astounding how you're running these articles about the vetting process of the vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party. Why don't the same standards apply to the presidential nominee of the Democrat Party? Can anybody say Rezko, Dorn, on and on and on?
Thank you very much. We want your opinion. What's your thought on all of this talk about Sarah Palin and vetting? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org, John?
Just the caller is referring to issues in Barack Obama's background and his fundraising efforts. Those names came up. But I'm sure there'll be more interesting vetting issues between now and November. The issue of child care and presidential children is on the minds of people in St. Paul. You know, childhood progeny of political parents. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? We wanted to send Stephen Dubner, our good friend and Freakonomics author, out to St. Paul to take a look at those issues as they are playing out. He's part of our convention team where Sarah Palin is set to speak tonight. And whatever she says on the minds of the people in the audience will be her children, particularly Bristol, her pregnant 17-year-old daughter. Stephen Dubner, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Do you mind if I call you Ocho Cinco Hockenberry just for the rest of the hour at least?
Call me Ocho, yeah. Or Ocho Berry. You can call me Ocho Berry. That's good.
Ocho Berry's good. My 8-year-old son, by the way, wants to be called Ocho Cinco now. He's a big football fan.
Really? Oh, that's great.
I think it's got a ring to it. Ocho Cinco Dubner.
Definitely.
Ocho Cinco Dubnero.
Well, let's pose the question right at the top. Are children historically a liability for high-profile parents, particularly political parents?
I love the question. The problem is to come up with a real answer is very hard because we have a small sample set, right? I mean, I guess if you worked really hard, you look at every major candidate of every race for the last 30 or 40 years, you could figure it out. But it's not a very big sample set, and there's a lot of anomalies. I will say this. They're obviously a big wild card. If you're a candidate and you've got a kid past the age of 12 or so, it's a big wild card to say the least. It's hard to imagine that Andrew Giuliani's pronounced virtual estrangement from his dad helped Rudolph Giuliani's campaign this past year. The Bush twins were some trouble. The Chip Carter, much more so, years and years ago. On the other hand, you know, it seems as if the children are model citizens, as the Gore daughters seem to be during that campaign, as the Kerry daughters seem to be. It doesn't really gain you that much. So it's hard to say empirically, yes, they're a political liability, or no, they're not. But we're in a situation right now with Bristol Palin where the big question is this daughter a political liability? If so, how?
Well, what about the question of her experience? She's pregnant. She's going to get married to her 17-year-old boyfriend, her high school sweetheart, presumably. What the prognosis for a teen who decides to become a mother? I mean, that's some Freakonomics right there.
You know, it is. On the one hand, it's a really interesting question. On the one hand, you could say, you know, people hear the phrase teen pregnancy and they flip, right? So I could counter that and just come from a different angle entirely and say, so what? You know, is it maybe totally elitist or classist or ageist to suggest that teen pregnancy in and of itself is bad? After all, teen pregnancy doesn't necessarily mean unwed mother. It may, but it doesn't necessarily, right? And also, you have to think about the biological and evolutionary drivers for teens to get pregnant. In other words, there was a strong, let's say, supply issue at play, which is women didn't live as long, nor did men, long ago, as our species was evolving, and fertility was really important, and it happened early, okay? So maybe all of these reasons are reasons to say, hey, let's all shut up about teen pregnancy being a scourge on humanity, or at least on our society.
What we're talking about today, when you do statistically, and obviously it changes from person to person, but statistically you're less likely to get an education, finish high school or college. You're more likely to have a baby that's born premature or low birth rate, which can signify some other health problems. You're to be living brought into poverty and to grow up in poverty. And those numbers are all overwhelming.
Right. That was the second hand of my argument, right? So every argument based in economics has to begin on the one hand. On the other hand, and as Harry Truman helpfully pointed out, you know, there's a third hand as well, which is why you need three-handed economists. So, yes, you could say maybe we should shut up about teen pregnancy. On the other hand, the empirical evidence shows that teen pregnancy in our society is not very good for the reasons that you named and many more. So babies who are born to young mothers tend to be lower birth weight often. They also tend much more likely for ADHD, the less likely to graduate from high school. Teen moms less likely to attend or complete college. Marriages much more likely to end in divorce, and on and on and on in this society. So you could say that there's an awful lot of reasons why we should be treating teen pregnancy as something to be prevented.
Well, so you're roaming the halls there. You're hanging out with the delegates. Do you think Sarah Palin, in her speech tonight, is going to deliver a cautionary note about the experience of her daughter Bristol? Or is it going to be more of a, hey, this is our life, we're doing it, cheer us on here?
Yeah, I would be shocked at the former. I would be not surprised at the latter. We just saw her kind of warming up on the stage. It's about a little bit before 7 o'clock local time here, and she was out fully coiffed and ready to go and looking extraordinarily poised as a bunch of cameras rolled, getting video of her saying nothing other than looking out at where the teleprompters were. Yeah, I think we've already seen the way the issue is going to play out. I would just say this, getting away from Bristol Palin for a moment, you know, The percentage of girls who've had sex by the age of 17 in this country has fallen significantly in the last 8-10 years, okay?
Wow.
If you look at it from a kind of incentive standpoint or a cost standpoint, you know, I like to talk about what price means. We tend to think of price as a dollar term, but it's not just that. Everything has a price, and it's not just dollars. The cost of sexual intercourse is pretty high. There's pregnancy, there's STDs, and so on. When there's a substitute available that is cheaper, you'll see people embrace it. That's what a market is about, right? In this case, the substitute is oral sex, right? So when we see the numbers about how oral sex has spiked in America, one of the big reasons is that intercourse has gotten more costly. It's always been costly, but now there's a substitute that is seen as A, much cheaper, and B, less socially horrific, I guess you'd say.
Freakonomics. That's why we call it Freakonomics here at The Takeaway. Stephen Dubner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Stephen. I did not know that. Did not know that.
Well, you see, I'm silent because I think I'm going to step
off. Yeah, because you're a chicken.
You're just
a chicken.
However, there's a takeaway perhaps there for someone. But if you want another takeaway, you want a takeaway fix, you can get one online at our website and on Facebook, Twitter, and FriendFeed.
We're following how you really vet a VP. The latest from the Republican National Convention, what's in a name. We're also asking you, how equal is the mother and father's responsibilities to take care of their children in the 21st century? Can Sarah Palin really balance her career and her family?
I live in West New York, New Jersey. My name is Maria. I was born in Cuba, but I'm a United States citizen. Parents, mother or father, man or woman, no matter, no put children in position to embarrass them. Sarah Palin embarrassed her family. She even got pregnant when she was not married. And now the same history with the daughter, Bristol. Children should come first, not politics. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. And here's today's takeaway, or at least another thought on one.
She really has to sort of reassure people that she is ready, A, to be a candidate to run for president, and B, to run for president.
That was the New York Times' Adam Nagorny talking about the woman at the center of the news. That would be Republican VP nominee Sarah Palin.
Adam Nagorny, that's a weird name. Nagorny's a
so
weird name.
So is John Hockenberry.
Hockenberry. Adoree Dodge, that's a strange name.
Quite normal in Nigeria.
Well, normal in Nigeria. Is that the title of your next movie? This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm Spartacus!
No!